Welcome to Conversations from the Pale Blue Dot. I'm your host, Luke Brog. Today I'll be speaking with Mike Lacona, a New Testament historian and Christian apologist.
So the background knowledge that people don't generally rise from the dead is not useful in us determining whether or not Jesus rose from the dead?
No, it's not helpful at all.
We both got pretty involved in this interview/debate about the resurrection of Jesus, so it's pretty long. But that gave us the time to go into some great details. Because it's so long, I'll get right to it. Here's my interview with Mike Lacona.
Mike Lacona is a New Testament historian and Christian apologist and will receive his PhD in New Testament studies from the University of Pretoria in South Africa early next year. He is the co-author with Gary Habermas of The Case for the Resurrection of Jesus. Mike, it's a pleasure to be speaking with you.
Well, thanks, Luke. Good to be on your program.
Now, Mike, before we dive into the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus, what has your own journey of faith been like?
Well, I became a Christian at the age of 10. Really didn't have my epistemological processes developed at that point. So it was purely an act of faith. Ended up going to Liberty University, a Christian university. I was a music major, played saxophone, planning on being a professional musician. And my love for reading the Bible and prayer just grew during that period of time. And I enrolled in a Greek course in my undergraduate work and loved it. And so decided I wanted to go for a master's in New Testament Greek, Koine Greek, for Common Greek. And ended up doing that and doing well in it in a master's course and took a bunch. Took the equivalent of 5 years of graduate level courses in Greek. And as I was studying the New Testament in its original language, I started one day to question and ask myself, is this stuff really true? You see, I became a Christian at the age of 10 and had never really given it much thought whether it was true. I just assumed it was. And then I got thinking, well, what about Muslims who've been brought up in Afghanistan? What about Hindus who've been brought up in India? What about atheists in China? Is it the reason that I'm a Christian is because that's the way I was brought up to believe? And if I'd been brought up differently in another country, maybe I'd be a follower of one of those other faiths or other worldviews. And so this really troubled me to a point where I almost gave up my faith. And I never had Gary Habermas for a course. But he had a really cool reputation at Liberty as a professor who was very approachable and would give you real answers. And so I went to him, and I remember going in his office, and we ended up talking. And then after graduating or finishing up at Liberty, I would call or email him a couple times and ask him more questions. And so that's how I was introduced to apologetics, because I was in New Testament studies when I was in grad school and specialized in Koine Greek. Later on, this would have been 5.5 years ago, I decided to get into a PhD program and do research on historical method and the resurrection of Jesus. And at this point, Gary Habermas and I had already written our book, The Case for the Resurrection of Jesus, or we're finishing up at that point. And Gary was familiar with a whole lot of what had been written on the resurrection. He had put together a bibliography of about 2,500 sources in French, German, and English written since 1975 on the resurrection, and familiar with where scholars were coming from and where they stood on different issues. And so I said to him, we've been looking at this resurrection thing for a while. Why is it that so many people can look at the same data and come to radically different conclusions? And who are these people who are writing on the resurrection? Most of them are biblical scholars and a few philosophers here and there. Are there any professional historians who have written extensively on it? And he said that he could only recall maybe a handful of professional historians outside of the community of biblical scholars who had delved into the resurrection of Jesus, gotten their feet wet with it. Only one had written a very small book on it, and maybe there were a handful of journal articles. But nothing had really been done. And I thought, well, are biblical scholars really qualified to do historical research? Have they had any training in it? And what's interesting, Luke, is then I went to the 8 Ivy League school websites and looked at their catalogs and for biblical studies or religious studies and philosophy for undergraduate, graduate, and doctoral level courses, and looked in their catalogs for courses and seminars that were offered on how to do history, historical method and philosophy of history. What is history? How do we come to have historical knowledge, and what does that mean? And of the 8 Ivy League schools, for undergraduate, graduate, and doctoral level courses, I only found 1 doctoral level seminar that was offered at Princeton. That was it. And yet a lot of these, their graduates are going to get out and say, I'm a historian, and let me tell you what I know about Jesus. And they hardly have any training whatsoever in history. So I decided that I would do my dissertation in this way, and on historical method, philosophy of history, apply that, find out what professional historians are doing and saying about how history is conducted, apply those types of methodology to the resurrection and see if there was a different approach. And I found some really cool stuff. But it was a very rewarding and very agonizing journey. One thing that I found in my first couple of years is that as I just studied works written by professional historians outside of the community of biblical scholars, is that if you're going to do a good investigation, you have to do your best at detaching yourself from your own personal bias. And virtually all historians will say that there's no way that any of us can be completely objective, that nobody is completely objective when it comes to any historical investigation, much less a religious one such as, say, the resurrection of Jesus. In fact, these guys are very clear that there's just no possible way to be completely neutral or objective when you're doing an investigation, and these are in non-religious matters. But what they say is you really have to try, and you detach yourself as much as you can from your personal bias and your desired outcomes. So this is something that I worked very, very hard at, because I'm a doubter by my very nature. That's just the way I'm wired. I'm always second guessing. So this was agonizing for me. And so I worked on my dissertation for 5.5 years. My dissertation is quite long. The average dissertation is 60,000 to 80,000 words. Mine was 272,000 words. Richard Hayes, the distinguished professor of New Testament at Duke, was one of my external readers, and he loved it. He was very pleased with the dissertation, gave the highest mark, but he said that it was so long and thorough and exhaustive in some of the things that it covered. He said even Duke wouldn't allow a dissertation that length, and a lot of schools wouldn't, but I just had to keep digging deeper and deeper, because it's something that was very important to me. My faith is important to me, not so much of whether what's important to me is that I know the truth. And if that meant abandoning Christianity, then so be it. And I was committed to finding the truth, and I don't expect everybody to believe me on that, but I know deep down inside that I did my best to conduct a good investigation, and I know that I was not able to be completely objective. I recognize that, but I can say that I did my best, and I was at several points, and my wife can verify that, even as late as last January, this past January, that I was lying in bed at night, and my wife said, "You're doubting again, aren't you?" I said, "Yep." She said, "Where are you? Where are you in your faith right now?" And I said, "Well, I believe God exists, and that's about all I'm sure of at this point." And so it has been a strain. It's been difficult for me. But I wanted to go through it. I wanted to agonize through this and do the best investigation I could so I could look back and say, well, I did this with the greatest integrity that I could muster. So that's kind of a journey of my faith, Luke.
Wow. Well, that's a great story. You talked about how very few professional historians have looked at the case for the resurrection, and that's maybe something new that you'd like to contribute. I keep being happily surprised by how much new work there is to be done on the subject of early Christianity. You said that you wrote the book with Gary Habermas mostly before your PhD work. Do you think that your perspective on that time and this particular issue has changed at all?
Yeah, there have been some things that have changed. In there, we present five facts. We call it 4+1. Gary calls it, has coined the minimal facts approach. That is, we consider facts that are only those that are so strongly evidenced that they have persuaded the strong majority of scholars to regard them as historical facts, and that would also include skeptical ones, rather skeptical ones. So we say 4+1 because I was standing on Gary's shoulders a lot of the time in this book in terms of his bean counting, you could call it, because he'd actually done it, one of the few who had actually done it. And he was saying nearly 100% recognized that Jesus died by crucifixion. Nearly 100% recognized that the disciples believed that Jesus rose and had appeared to them. He said nearly 100% will grant that Paul was a skeptic who converted to Christianity because he believed Jesus rose and appeared to him. He said about 90% believe that, or the half-brother of Jesus, James, was a skeptic prior to the resurrection and that he converted to Christianity as a result of a post-resurrection appearance of Jesus. And then we distinguish the one, which is the empty tomb, we call 4+1, because it's still strongly evidenced, we believe, and has a strong majority of scholars, but it's somewhere between 2/3 and 3/4% of all the scholars writing on the subject today, since 1975, that is. But because it didn't get the 90% or better, then we kind of put it in a separate category. In my dissertation, what I did was I took a similar approach. It was a little nuanced from what Gary typically does and what we present in the case for the resurrection of Jesus. I use a term, not that Gary uses, for minimal facts, but the one that is used more commonly within New Testament scholarship, and that is what we would call historical bedrock. And that would be facts that are so strongly evidenced, virtually everyone agrees with them, and any hypothesis that you are going to build to account for those, for what happened, like a portrait of Jesus or whatever you're building on, it has to be built upon those facts because they are the foundation. So anything that you, when you start off with a portrait of Jesus and say, this is what the real Jesus was like, any portrait has to account for those facts. And if it can't account for any of those facts, then it is a defective portrait and needs to be either canned or reworked to include them somehow. So with that in mind, I looked and said, what are the relevant historical bedrock? And, okay, James is kind of interesting. You got 90%. That's really strong. But in my research, I could only find about 20 people who wrote on it, who comment on it. And now I have to admit, I didn't look through all the commentaries on James, so there could be a whole lot more. But in the stuff on resurrection and stuff on 1 Corinthians 15, there's just not a lot of scholars who comment on whether James was a skeptic. Now, I could probably go to John. I could probably go to Mark, chapter 3, and John chapter 5, I believe it is, that says none of Jesus' brothers believed in him. And I could probably look at those to see what those scholars are saying. And it could be that when you take all those into consideration, then you have a much higher number that say that they were skeptics. All Jesus' brothers were skeptics. But I didn't go that far and do that. So those counting on the resurrection, I only counted about 20 or somewhere around there. And about 90% of those, all but pretty much John Painter, Richard Bauckham, and James Tabor. Those were the only three I could find that questioned whether they were skeptics prior to the resurrection. So I think we've got a high enough percentage, but there weren't enough scholars that I found commenting on it, so I didn't want to put that in the historical bedrock. And the empty tomb, because there's only 2/3 to 3/4, and in the book we say 3/4, but Gary has found a whole lot of sources more on it since then, and he says now it's somewhere between 2/3 and 3/4. Still a very strong majority, but it wasn't strong enough, large enough to meet my qualifications within my dissertation for historical bedrock. So I did not include that. Some of my thoughts about the arguments for the empty tomb, such as the Jerusalem factor, enemy attested, as in Matthew 28 or 27, where they were saying the disciples, it was 28, I'm sorry, the disciples came and stole the body. I don't regard that as persuasive or the same amount of weight that I did when we wrote Case for Resurrection. I always thought, regarded that as the strongest argument for the empty tomb. Gary never did. He liked the argument from women and their low standing in the first century. But I like the enemy attested the best. I've since revised that and think it's still a legitimate reason, but I don't think it carries the weight that I thought it did when we wrote the book. I'm also not as confident about historical method as I was back then. I realize, according to virtually all the professional historians who are writing on the subject, that when we say, as historians, that something occurred in the past, what we're really saying is, given the available data we have, when we compare rival hypotheses, this one right here, our preferred one, and it's preferred because it's met the criteria for the best explanation, better than any other explanation, we think that this is what probably occurred in the past. And there's various degrees of probability, but whatever we believe in terms of this happening, we always keep our hands open to say, well, it could have been otherwise. There might come something revealed in the future that would cause us to revise our hypothesis or abandon it altogether. And that really was a sobering conclusion, when I'm discovering that this is what professional historians and how they approach things. And then I remembered a meal that I had with two professors at MIT in the area of physics and one a professor of philosophy of science at Harvard. The four of us had dinner one evening. And I was telling them about, what historians, what criteria they use for the best explanation and how certain we must be. And I said, what do you guys do in physics? And the one physics professor said, well, Mike, typically we just form a hypothesis and try to fit the data. Sometimes it fits well, sometimes it doesn't. The problem is that the data is usually very fragmented. It's not complete. And we say something happened, but a lot of what we hold today is abandoned within a few years, and we're really certain about very, very little in physics. I said, you're kidding me. I mean, physics is, to my understanding, the strongest of all the sciences because it's based on mathematics. Mm-hmm. And he said, yep, it is. And it is the strongest of all the sciences, but in terms of the kind of certainty we can have. But again, our pool of knowledge of data is usually so fragmented that there's very little that we can be certain of. And the other physics professor agreed, and then I looked over at the philosopher of science professor at Harvard, and he just smiled and said, yep, that's the way it is. And that was really enlightening to me, because I thought, wow, when you read and you hear different scientific theories and they're saying this is absolute scientific knowledge about so many things, that's not the way the physicists are talking at MIT, which is arguably the best physics university in the world. And these are what the professors were saying. So it doesn't surprise me then that that is the way it is in historical research as well. But it still bothers me. I have this Cartesian anxiety, you could say. I just want absolute certainty, and I can't have it. And you really can't have that about much in history at all either. So I recognize that, and I've been humbled in that sense through my research.
Yeah, well, if that's the state of physics research, then historians have a tremendously difficult job. One little plate found over here, one little fragment of a bone over here can just shift our history around completely, because we're trying to build up a whole story from just tiny little bits and pieces here and there, and it can be a very difficult thing to do.
Well, you're right, Luke. You're right, and it's humbling. But as I said, you find that it's not just the historian's challenge, it's the challenge of all sciences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, let's talk about the resurrection. First of all, why is it important for Christians to defend the resurrection with reason and evidence?
Why is it important for them to defend it? I would guess because it is being challenged. It always has been challenged. And, you know, the apostles, they, when they went out, if we are to believe Acts, the book of Acts, if we are to believe Paul, in his letters, the resurrection was a focal point of the earliest Christian preaching. That when they were preaching the gospel, that Jesus is who he claimed to be. He claimed to be the uniquely divine Son of God, that we could have salvation only through him, that he died for our sins, that he rose from the dead, and that we could have a personal relationship with him. They said that his resurrection was evidence that these things were true. So, like Paul said in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 17, he said, if Christ has not been raised, your faith is useless. And in Greek, the word useless appears first in the clause, and so it has great emphasis. So useless, utterly worthless is your faith if Christ has not been raised from the dead. And that would seem to be very consistent with the claims of Jesus as reported in the Gospels in terms of when the skeptic said, show us a sign that you are who you say you are. And he said, I'll give you one sign, my resurrection from the dead. So if he didn't rise from the dead, he's a false prophet whom no rational person should follow. But if he did rise from the dead, that's going to give us something we're going to have to think very seriously about in terms of our response to God and our own personal worldview.
Okay. Well, let's hear it. What's your condensed case for the resurrection of Jesus in Palestine 2,000 years ago?
Well, let's talk about those facts, the relevant historical bedrock. That is the facts that are so strongly evidenced, almost everyone agrees with it. It crosses theological lines for the most part, worldview lines, so it's heterogeneous in terms of the types of people who agree with these, and it's because the evidence behind them is strong. And I'll just give those three facts, and then we can if you'd like, question me on them, I can unpack them and say this is why most scholars agree with them. So, number one, we would have Jesus' death by crucifixion. Number two, we would have the beliefs of Jesus' disciples that he had risen from the dead and had appeared to them in both individual and group settings. And number three, there was a skeptic, a persecutor of the church named Paul, who converted to Christianity because he had an experience that he perceived was the risen Jesus appearing to him. So those are our three facts that are virtually undisputed within the academic community. Now, of course, you find a few on the fringe who will dispute them. I mean, we find people who deny the Holocaust. You find all kinds of those on the fringe. You find people who deny that Jesus ever existed. But no serious scholar who is widely respected grants those things or takes those positions. So I'm talking about, with the exception of the fringe on either the right or the left, these virtually 100% of all scholars acknowledge these three facts. So now, with that in mind, those three facts, what do we do with those facts? And I look at a historical hypothesis as sort of like putting a jigsaw puzzle together. If you imagine, a jigsaw puzzle with 100 pieces, your solution to that puzzle, you don't want to leave pieces stranded. The best solution is going to include all of the pieces. So the one that includes the most pieces is superior in that particular sense. But on the other hand, you don't want to force pieces to fit. Or, you can make them fit, but they really just don't go there when you look at the pattern in them. You want them to fit where it seems naturally easy, where they fit. And those that have to force the pieces are inferior to those solutions where the pieces don't have to be forced to fit. So if you just look at those two things, and there are a couple other criteria we could use, but those are very important. Look at those two criteria, and let's weigh a couple hypotheses based on that. So say resurrection hypothesis. It certainly explains all three of those facts Jesus' death by crucifixion. You can't have a resurrection without a crucifixion, a death, that is. The beliefs of the disciples that he rose and appeared to them, and a conversion of a skeptic who persecuted the church because he believed the risen Jesus appeared to him. Resurrection hypothesis explains all three of those facts, and it explains them without forcing any of them to fit. They fit very naturally, very easily. Now take something like a hallucination hypothesis. It accounts wonderfully for Jesus' death by crucifixion, which would certainly have put the disciples in a frame of mind that could have made them candidates for hallucinations, because they were grief-stricken, it was sudden, it was brutal, they were fearful, now they were confused. They're prime candidates for hallucination. Throw in Peter's denial of Jesus, and now he has guilt. Wow. So that fits wonderfully with the hallucination hypothesis. What about the second fact? Let's take the beliefs of the disciples in individual and group settings that Jesus had appeared to them. Well, it would account for individual settings, such as, let's say, the appearance to Peter. But it would have a little more difficulty accounting for the group appearances, because hallucinations aren't typically experienced in groups. They're not contagious either. So hallucinations are private occurrences in the mind of an individual. They're like dreams. I couldn't wake up my wife in the middle of the night and say, "Honey, I'm having this dream. We're in Hawaii. Go back to sleep. Join me in my dream and let's have a free vacation." You can't do that because I'm having this dream about I'm in Hawaii. She might even be dreaming she's in Hawaii, but we're not interacting within the same dream. That's impossible. And it's the same thing with a hallucination. So the group experiences phenomena make it far more difficult to explain by hallucination. And then it makes it difficult to explain what happened with Paul. He's not grief-stricken over Jesus' death, so he's not so much a candidate for hallucinations. So I don't think that the hallucination hypothesis, as we see presented, say, by Gert Ludemann, Michael Gulder, and others, I don't think it works very well, historically speaking. It can't account for those facts. It leaves them stranded. And then when you try to do account for them, say, group hallucinations, you're really trying to force those pieces of the puzzle to fit, where they just don't go naturally. They don't go easily, simply. So as purely speaking, weighing hypotheses as historians would with their criteria, the hallucination hypothesis fails miserably, whereas the resurrection hypothesis works out really, really well. And that's just looking at hallucination. When you compare it with other hypotheses, they meet with the same kind of fate.
So you're focusing now on three facts: the crucifixion of Jesus, the conversion of Paul, and the conversion of James?
No, not James. The beliefs of the disciples and individual and or the beliefs of the disciples that Jesus appeared to them, risen from the dead, in individual and group settings.
Oh, okay. I'm a little confused because you're using the conversion of Paul and the strong beliefs of the disciples as evidence that the resurrection actually happened, but people change religions all the time, and it doesn't seem like we would use that as evidence for, George Harrison's conversion from Christianity to Hinduism. We wouldn't use that as evidence for Krishna, or Muhammad Ali from Baptist to Nation of Islam to Sunni Islam. We wouldn't use that as evidence for Allah. And likewise, people for all different kinds of faiths have believed really, really strongly, such that they would die for their faiths. Muslims, Baha'is, Sikhs, Jains, many of them all throughout history willing to die for their beliefs because their beliefs were so strong. So why would conversion or really strong belief be evidence for the resurrection of Jesus?
That's a fair question, Luke. I would respond to say there is a big difference between the ones you've mentioned and the apostles and Paul. When you talk about someone like George Harrison, Muhammad Ali, and others who convert to another religion, they convert for whatever reasons they're doing, because they like the message of that other religion, because they sat down with someone who convinced them that that religion is true, and for whatever reasons, they convert to that religion. Geza Vermesh, as a Jewish scholar. He was Roman Catholic, and he converted to Judaism. So you have those things all the time. The difference between that and, say, the disciples and Paul is they converted not based on sitting down and hearing the message of another person. And when I'm talking about conversion, I'm saying with them. We're talking about their beliefs, sincere beliefs that Jesus had risen from the dead and had appeared to them. George Harrison never claimed, and Muhammad Ali never claimed that, say, Krishna for Harrison or Muhammad or an angel for Muhammad Ali appeared to them and gave them divine revelation. The disciples were saying that Jesus actually rose from the dead and appeared to them. And this is what we believe. This is what we're willing to stake our lives and souls on. It's kind of like you and me. Perhaps we might die for what we believe is true. But the disciples and Paul suffered and were willing to die for what they either knew was true or false. So do you understand that difference? It's kind of like a Muslim terrorist. They die today. They blow themselves up for what they sincerely, honestly believe is true. They haven't seen Muhammad. They didn't see the angel Gabriel whom Muhammad said appeared to him. They didn't see the divine Quran in heaven. They are going on the word of the Quran that this is true. The disciples and Paul weren't going on the word of anyone else. They had a direct experience that they interpreted as the risen Jesus appearing to them. And that is why they came to that belief.
Well, now, that's fine, but there are also many, many other people who have converted and been willing to die for their belief because of direct contact with other gods. That's often how religions start. For example, Muhammad, created a new religion because he had a direct contact with Gabriel, supposedly, or other founders of other religions, or even people in the present day who say that they get a vision from Jesus and convert from Chinese traditional religion to Christianity, or a vision of the angel Gabriel talking to them about Islam. Those kinds of things also happen today, and yet we wouldn't say that because they had a direct contact with a spirit, that's evident that that spirit actually exists, because we know that people come to believe false things through, misinterpretations of their own psychic phenomenon all the time. So again, I'm seeing lots of other examples that seem to me to be exactly the same as those of Paul and the Christian disciples, and yet we don't use those as evidence for the other gods and deities that might be out there.
I think that's, again, a fair observation, Luke. I guess for that I would say, let's take Muhammad, for example. When you read the earliest Islamic writings, say, Tabari, and the Sirat Rasulullah, the life of Muhammad, the earliest biography that we have, extant biography on Muhammad, Tabari would be the first Muslim historian, highly, highly revered by Muslims. They report that Muhammad, when he started to have his initial revelations from Gabriel, that he believed that he was being plagued by demons. In fact, he even was seriously contemplating suicide because he was troubled so much by it. Descriptions that he provided, at least as we find preserved in these early Islamic writings, is that the angel Gabriel would tell him to read the Quran, and he'd say, I can't read, and the angel would say, read, and I can't read, and the angel would start choking him, and this happened a couple times. He thought that the angel was going to choke him to death, and so he thought he was being plagued by demons, and it was his wife and one of her relatives who convinced him that it wasn't a demon that was troubling him, that he was actually being called to be a prophet of God. Now, of course, they didn't have the experience. That was their interpretation, and it was different than his own. And finally, they were able to convince him and persuade him of their interpretation. But the question I would say is, how do we know that Muhammad wasn't mistaken in his initial belief that he was being plagued by demons? Within the Quran itself, there are tests. There's one test that is provided in the Quran, and only one, for us to know whether Islam is true, whether the Quran is from God. And it says, try to write a surah, a chapter. The Quran has 114 surahs. They're all independent. They're arranged after the first one, which is an introductory one. They're arranged from the longest to the shortest. They're not in chronological order. They don't follow the same type of theme. They're just arranged that way. It's kind of like the Psalms, only the Psalms aren't arranged in any kind of size order. So they're all independent. But a number of times throughout the Quran, there's only one test provided, and it said, write a surah like one in here, and you'll find that you can't do it. Get all the wisest people in the world, get all the wisest jinn, that's like spiritual beings, and come together and try to create a surah like it, and you'll find that you can't. Well, I'd like to submit to you that if you go to choose any of the last 10 surahs in the Quran, they're pretty short, and just read through some of those and ask yourself, could I write something more sophisticated, more beautiful than what I read here? And if a Muslim comes back and says, yes, but you have to do it in Arabic because Arabic's such a, if you read it in Arabic, it's such a beautiful language. You say, well, yeah, well, why do I have to do it in Arabic? I don't particularly find Arabic to be beautiful. What if I like Hebrew better? What if I like Chinese better? What if I like English better? What if I like Spanish or Italian or French better? You know, it's just an arbitrary choice of preference. It's no different than choosing between McDonald's and Burger King. So I think it's a bad test, and I think it's the Quran is easily defeated in this way. And in fact, I think someone was brilliant when they put together what's called the Noble Furqan. When someone put together this book based on, I think it's 77 surahs, and did it in Arabic, and there's an English translation, and the people who put this together went over into some Muslim countries, they're Arabic speaking, people who wrote this thing, and they went to Muslim countries and they got on buses and went out in the streets and they started reading from the Noble Furqan, and people say, thank you for reading from the Quran, that was beautiful. And they said, I have not read from the Quran, I've read from the Furqan. So it proved that you know, the Quran is not inspired by God. It flunks its own test. But different when you come to the New Testament, and I think that we can show historically speaking, I could give you six arguments, historical arguments to show that Jesus predicted his violent imminent death and his subsequent resurrection by God. So if Jesus actually made those claims, and then all of a sudden we've got some pretty good historical evidence afterward to show that a bunch of people, friends and foes, in individual and group settings, believed that Jesus had risen from the dead and had appeared to them. And you put all these things together, and this is just dealing with the relevant historical bedrock. Forget the empty tomb, forget James, you throw those in, you make your case even stronger. But you just take those three facts, and then you look at the fact that Jesus predicted his violent imminent death and subsequent resurrection, and you go, whoa, this is pretty cool. This is much different than what we find in Islam. It's much different than what we find in Hinduism, or say with Krishna, you know, the great battle that's described in the Bhagavad Gita, supposedly happened in 3000 BC. And yet, the earliest reports that we have, or mention we have of Krishna within the historical record, doesn't occur until 400 to 500 years BC, or 2500 to 2600 years after he allegedly came to earth. That's huge. I mean, that's like the Buddha dying, and the first mention of the Buddha that we have in the historical record is 100 years from right now, Luke. That's the equivalent of what we have for Krishna. Compare that now with Jesus. We've got people who said they walked with him, they saw him in individual group settings, friend and foe alike. That's a lot stronger than what we have for other world religions.
Yeah, and I think you and I are equally critical of Islam or Hinduism. I certainly won't argue the weakness of their position. And I think you can always find differences between the early disciples and Paul versus the hundreds of other people, thousands of other people who have had mystical experiences with spirits and then converted and believed very strongly, there will always be differences there. But I think that for me, they are the same in the essential way that these people all had experiences that they thought were with spiritual beings from dozens of different religions, but they all thought they had spiritual experiences and then believed that those experiences were real so strongly that they converted, and some of them died for these beliefs or were persecuted for these beliefs. And so for me, the fact of religious conversion or mystical experience is just not very good evidence for the actual truth of those experiences, because they happen all the time and from contradictory religions and contradictory gods.
Okay, but let's look at what that really does, what you say. Now, I don't dispute that a lot of people in the past have had spiritual encounters. I'm not a naturalist. I could give you dozens of accounts of things that I believe to be credible where there have been spiritual encounters. I've had a few of my own. Some make the hair on the back of my neck go up when I think about them. They've not been pleasant. I know a guy, he's a scholar, a very careful scholar, one I highly respect, and he has been over in Africa in tribal villages and has seen really, really strange things. I have another friend. He's Yale educated, Master of Divinity from Yale. He goes over to China. He goes to Afghanistan. He goes into Iran. He goes to India. He ministers to the underground church. These bold and very courageous Christians who are willing to be imprisoned and give up their lives because they're that serious about their faith. What I mean, be martyred for their faith. He told me a story about being in China and talking to a group of former Muslims who had converted to Christianity. And when he's talking with them, they said, you know, we'd like some advice about this one spirit that's been visiting us. And he's a real tall guy, long gray hair, wears a very white robe, and he's threatening us. He just appears out of nowhere, and he threatens us that if we don't stop preaching the gospel, he's going to kill us and our families. What do we do about this? And my friend said, and I don't want to give out his name just for his protection, but he told me, he said that he didn't believe these folks. He thought they were a little strange. And then he was supposed to speak to them. He said, well, you know, I'll get back to you on that. He was supposed to speak to them. He said, could I use your restroom? Yeah, go down that hall, and it's right at the end. So he's walking down the hall, and all of a sudden, everything goes dark. And out of nowhere, the spirit that they had been describing flies up to him and grabs him around the neck and starts choking him. And he said, Mike, I felt he was going to kill me. I felt I was dying. And he said, I was able to utter, you want to kill me, but I have come now to destroy you in the name of Jesus. And at that point, the spirit let him go and flew off. He went out. He said, then I went to the bathroom. I said, you still had to go? And he said, yeah, I went to the bathroom. And then I went out and I talked to the group of individuals. And as soon as I got out there to talk to these Christians who were formerly Muslims, they said, you saw him, didn't you? And he said, how'd you know? And they said, because your face is really white with fear. So I could give you a number of stories like this from individuals that I know, that I know they're not crazy. And they've been overseas. They have these experiences. I've had some experiences over here in the U.S. I believe that these kinds of things happen. But it's still different than what we have from the resurrection. You might have a spirit, and look, I would interpret a spirit coming up someone and saying, let me tell you the truth about a religion. Within my Christian worldview, now I'm not talking as a historian, I'm talking as a Christian, within the framework of my Christian beliefs, I would say that that's probably a demon passing along false religion. That's still different from a person believing that, like Muhammad did, and then others, like Paul converting to Christianity and the disciples turning around from cowards to now those boldly proclaiming the message of Jesus to their own demise, because they sincerely were convinced that Jesus had risen from the dead. They'd seen him die, and now they'd seen him alive afterward, and they were convinced that he had risen from the dead and had appeared to them and spent time with them. That's still different than what we have with other accounts like what we have of Muhammad. And, yeah, there might be some others that started from spiritual beings talking to them. We'd have to look at those one at a time. There are not many of them like that, Luke. So we would have to talk about those specifically. And I'd be willing to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think for me, it's just not cutting it. But I actually do have my own encounter with a spirit that I believed was such when I was a Christian. But now I tend to think that it's more likely part of my brain's powerful simulation software than that I was actually visited by an invisible being that just wanted to fly around and scare me for a while. But I don't know. It was certainly a weird experience.
You don't believe, I mean, you had that experience. Do you believe it was a hallucination? Or do you believe that that was a real spiritual being of some sort that was before you doing the things he was doing?
Oh, I really don't think that it was a real spiritual being. I certainly did at the time because I had a Christian worldview that interpreted anything weird or any weird feeling I had. I would say, oh, this is the Holy Spirit, or I would get a warm, fuzzy feeling in my stomach and I would say, this is a piece of God. But now, for many other reasons that I write about all over the place, I don't think that that's very probable.
So what do you think it was? How would you account for it now?
Well, it very well could have been a hallucination. It could have been the, you know, shadows and light coming in through the window. It could have been a dream. It was actually late at night while I was tossing and turning in bed. So there are lots of explanations, but even still, even if I have no other explanation, there are lots of things about this universe that we don't understand, and to say that that is more likely to be an invisible being that just wanted to fly around on my ceiling for a while strikes me as a real far shot. It's kind of like saying we don't have a theory to explain lightning yet, so therefore Zeus must do it.
Right, a god of the gaps.
Right.
So, and I don't want a god of the gaps theory, but we don't want a naturalism of the gaps necessarily either. And when you plug in the unknown and say, well, I'm going to reject the supernatural, it's probably a natural explanation that we'll discover in the future. Well, you've done no different than a god of the gaps. You've done a naturalism of the gaps. I know what you're saying about the peace of God. How do you know that that's really God's peace or whether you're just in one of those moods? There were times when, after I had a few of those frightening experiences, that now I was really afraid I was going to have one. And then there were times that I thought I sensed something. I didn't see anything or hear anything on certain occasions. I mean, other occasions I did, but there'd be other occasions I didn't see or hear anything, but I just thought I perceived a presence. Well, is that because I was afraid and I was anticipating something? Very well could be the case. I don't know. But there are so many times when we don't know how to explain things. I have a friend up in Virginia Beach who, when she was, before she got married, she's living at home, bunk bed with her sister. She's on the bottom bunk, and she's awakened one morning, like at 2:30, and the light outside, the street light's out, and it's totally black. And she closes her eyes, opens them again, and she sees the face of an old friend in front of her who looks very depressed and frightened. And it's like lit up in front of her. She, whoa, that's really weird. And she, I must be dreaming. Closes her eyes, opens again. There it is again. She's fearful. She closes her eyes, opens them again. And now she sees the same face. And right behind it, she sees the face of like a demon, but smiling. And she's very scared. And she's like pinching herself, hitting her head, thinking, am I hallucinating? Am I dreaming? I need to get out of this. This is very scary. And she closes her eyes, opens up, still there. Then she says the Lord's Prayer, and it goes away. She goes back to sleep, and she gets up the next morning, goes downstairs, and her parents are there. She said, I knew it was a Palm Sunday. She said, I'll never forget it. My dad was reading the paper. My mom was cooking breakfast, and my dad said, hey, did you know Susie so-and-so? And yeah, well, she died last night. She was at so-and-so and at the Scope Auditorium and fell off a couple stories and at like midnight, and they took her to the hospital. She died at 2:30. Well, my friend Pat had looked over at the clock when this happened. It was 2:30. I said, okay, well, Is there a naturalistic explanation for that, or does that seem to indicate that there is a supernatural realm? And you start putting a bunch of stories like that together. Some are stronger than the others. I think that one's a pretty strong one. You put a bunch of those things together and go, well, I think maybe reality is a little more complex than what atheism likes to grant it. And then you throw in there something like Jesus' predictions about his death and resurrection, his claims to divinity. And all of a sudden, guess what? All the historical evidence we have seems to point to a resurrection from the dead. Well, again, when you use and you weigh hypotheses according to the criteria historians provide, resurrection hypothesis comes out for the best explanation. And you can reject resurrection, but offer an alternative hypothesis for the data. Let's weigh it, see which one comes out better, and go with the best explanation.
Well, Mike, I feel like we're teenagers huddled around a fire sharing ghost stories now. But I want to go back to, real quickly, the naturalism of the gaps comment that you made. I think that when we encounter something like that, a really good answer is we just don't know. But in addition to that, I think that there actually is some historical precedent for preferring natural explanations. And here's what I mean by that. Throughout history, we've had this pretty much unstoppable trend of early on everything having magical explanations. Birth, death, disease, cosmology, water, crop failure, weather, everything was spirits. And then as our knowledge has increased, a lot of those have gone away and we've realized, oh, that's germs. Stars. And that's been just kind of an unstoppable trend throughout history where we used to think that everything was supernatural and we're realizing that all of these things are really not so spooky. So when we encounter something that's spooky now, it's an open question. It might be a spirit or it might have a natural explanation we just haven't encountered yet. But given history, I would say it's just infinitely more likely to be the latter.
You say infinitely, or well, I know you're using exaggeration there, but greatly.
Yeah.
Why would you say it's greatly more likely that it's a natural explanation over a supernatural one?
Well, just because I think that that's what history has taught us. Because we used to explain everything with supernatural things, and consistently supernatural explanations have been replaced with scientific ones as we gain new knowledge. But it isn't generally the trend that things we used to explain with science are now being accepted as having supernatural explanations. The trend is the opposite way.
I would say that that is not correct necessarily. I would agree with you that it has gone from attributing almost everything that we didn't know about to the gods, spirits, to when we came to the Enlightenment period, to get to a point where you say that everything has a natural explanation. And of course, that's metaphysics. That's not physics. To say everything has a natural explanation, well, you don't know that. We try to find a natural explanation. And since the Enlightenment, the scientific community has very much been involved in trying to do just that. But offering a natural explanation does not mean that that's what it truly is. I think this became evident very clearly in the recent movie with Ben Stein, Expelled. I think it became painfully obvious as we looked at what Richard Dawkins and Michael Ruse said when they said, well, how did life originate if God didn't do it? And Dawkins said, well, we really don't know. It may have come from outer space somehow, from another planet. Well, then how did it get there? Well, we really don't know. We just don't have any idea how it came. We just got speculations. Michael Ruse says, well, it probably evolved on the backs of crystals. Well, how did that happen? Well, it just happened that way. We don't know how it would have happened that way. That's just a conception of how it happened. So the skeptics can't agree amongst themselves how it happened, but both Dawkins and Ruse in that movie said, we don't really know how life originated by natural causes. It just did. You got Francis Crick, an atheist scientist who discovered DNA, and he said that DNA is so complex in itself that there's no possible way, given a 4.5 billion year old Earth, that have evolved by chance here on Earth. And that's why he comes up with the theory, directed panspermia, that it came from another planet. But of course, that just backs it up to another planet that's undetectable, and it had to evolve to an extreme complex life form even quicker than it would have on Earth. It actually complicates the problem. So my point here is this, and Michael Ruse, I'll add one more thing. Michael Ruse is an agnostic. I appreciate his honesty. I heard him personally say that metaphysical or naturalistic evolution, the belief that we all got here by natural causes, that life began that way, requires a metaphysical commitment and an act of faith. That's from one of the leading evolutionists out there today. Mm-hmm. So merely offering a naturalistic explanation and calling it science does not mean that that has been established. It just means that that is what they are believing, because a supernatural explanation is unpalatable to them. The move from naturalism, there is a move by many going away from that right now, and one only need to pick up the theme issue for 2006 of History and Theory, pretty much the only journal out there on the philosophy of history. And it was dedicated to religion and historians, miracles and historians. And many of the professional historians in there said that to say that historians cannot investigate miracle claims, or that miracles should be ruled out as impossible, is going back to an outdated Enlightenment view, and that a paradigm shift needs to occur because too much phenomena cannot be explained by naturalism, and we have to now be open to the supernatural and account for it.
Well, Mike, the example you gave of abiogenesis is still an open question, so that's perfectly correct that we don't know. But I'm talking about how throughout history, all these, you know, germ theory is not really an open question anymore. Everybody knows that diseases are caused by germs, not by spirits. And there are just thousands and thousands of those. So abiogenesis is still a totally open question that we don't have the explanation for. We don't know how it happened. But the trend is still this incredible move from spiritual explanations for everything to a lot of these being explained much better and much more predictably and much more usefully by natural explanations. And so if we're going to say that, unknown thing, say abiogenesis, is probably going to be explained by Vahaguru or Quetzalcoatl or Yahweh, that's fine, but it doesn't really fit with the trend. So maybe that could happen, but I think it's unlikely because it doesn't fit with the trend of history. And
I agree with you that a number of things have, like you mentioned, lightning and thunder. We know that it's not the angels and bowling in heaven, right? And we know that the changes in seasons aren't because Baal died and then he was brought back to life and let go out of the belly of Mott. We know those kinds of things. We can recognize some legends, and we do recognize why the seasons change. We recognize why thunder and lightning happens. And that's fine. And I'm all against God of the Gaps theories. But I don't think the resurrection is a God of the Gaps theory. We have a number of data in our relevant historical bedrock. And when we put these things together and weigh hypotheses for their ability to explain the facts and do so without pushing them, forcing them to fit, the resurrection hypothesis comes out on top every time. Maybe you can present a naturalistic hypothesis that we can look at, Luke, and weigh in that way. But I do think that a naturalism of the gaps, even if it's a trend within the scientific community, a naturalism of the gaps is just as guilty of being bad and an ad hoc construction based on worldview rather than data. A naturalism of the gaps is just as guilty as a God of the gaps is that. And I think it should be avoided as well. And just like the abiogenesis, we need to recognize that the scientific theories, and again, I remember the words of the physicists, that there's very little in science for which we're really certain, and that we're changing things all the time. It's happening in biology. It's happening in physics. It's happening all around. So I wouldn't say that a trend is just to say that we're going with naturalistic explanations. Yes, that might be the case. But a lot of those things that are naturalistic explanations or naturalism of the gaps, they have not at all been proven.
Well, yeah, let's get back to the resurrection then. I think Christian apologists in general are very good at making their arguments sound reasonable in the abstract or even when talking about Jesus or Christianity. But when you apply those ways of thinking to other situations, to me at least, it just becomes really bizarre. For example, there are lots of other stories from the ancient world of dying and rising gods, magical healers, etc. Other early Christian writings talk about Peter resurrecting a tuna fish from the dead, or healing people with his shadow, or knocking the sorcerer Simon Magus out of the sky while he's flying so that he crashes the ground and dies. But we don't believe those stories because they're so absurd. They contradict everything we know about the universe and everything we've ever experienced. But of course we know that people hallucinate or have dreams or are confused or simply tell lies or make up stories. That happens all the time. So why would we think that all of those other magical stories in that era are hallucinations or lies or whatever, but the story about Jesus rising from the dead and walking through walls and flying off into the sky, why would we think that those actually happened? What's the crucial difference here?
That's a great question. First of all, I'd say you got to look at your different examples of your dying and rising gods in the first century era and the centuries that surround it. There aren't any clear parallels of dying and rising gods that predate Christianity. The earliest you have is Adonis, and he appears around the year 150. Now, the Adonis religion is older than Christianity, but the first account of him dying and rising from the dead doesn't occur until about 150 A.D. or more than 100 years after Jesus' death. So it's hard to say that Christianity copied off of Adonis. If anything, the opposite happened.
Can I just jump in here, Mike, and say that I totally agree with you here. A lot of atheists love to make arguments that Jesus was a copy of Apollonius or Adonis or whatever, but you're actually correct. All of those accounts come after Jesus, so if anything, they were copied from Jesus. But that's not the point I'm making. I'm making a point that there are so many magical stories from before or from after, and they just are clearly legendary. But when we look at the story of Jesus, and he's, you know, dying and rising and flying off into the sky, how is that one different? Why, you know, when we're reading through the narratives of the ancient library and we come to that one, why is that one actually true and all the other ones are ridiculous?
We get back to our relevant historical bedrock. When you take, let's say, Apollonius, because he's probably the most frequently cited example. What we have with Apollonius, we only have one extant source, and that is Philostratus' biography, which was written about 125 to 130 years after Apollonius' death. And he's not the only one writing on it, but it's the only extant source that we have. He probably had one other competitor that we really know nothing about. We don't have his writings any longer, so it's hard to say anything there. And we don't know what he said. But Philostratus says he got all his information from a guy named Damas, who appears to be a mythical character because he's from Nineveh, which hadn't existed for hundreds of years at that point. Loeb Classical Library Series has, a couple years ago, just came out with the revised Philostratus's Life of Apollonius of Tyana. Mm-hmm. And Christopher Jones is the editor and translator, and he comments on this stuff too. And he says that that Damas was probably a mythical figure, just something. So we don't really know if Philostratus just made this stuff up or what. But there's only one account, one sighting that's mentioned of Apollonius. We don't know when it was made. We don't know the name of the person. It was just someone who liked Apollonius. We don't know if it was someone who'd ever seen Apollonius. But he just liked Apollonius, and he was dreaming, and he dreamt that Apollonius appeared to him. Now, that is a stark difference from what we have with the appearance accounts of Jesus. It's not someone who's appearing to someone in a dream or dreams that he sees someone. more than 130 years after, I shouldn't say more than 130 years, it happened within that period of time, because if it happened at all, because Philostratus is mentioned in this. So it's only one account of someone who saw Apollonius in a dream. That's far different than what we have with actual eyewitnesses, according to, remember, our relevant historical bedrock. Everybody agrees that the disciples themselves and the skeptic Paul had experiences that they believed were the risen Jesus appearing personally right before them. So that's different than what we find with Apollonius. Baal is cited at times. In fact, T.N.D. Metinger, in one of the most recent treatments on the subject, it's called The Riddle of Resurrection. I think it was written in 2001. He's a senior Swedish scholar. And he admits, he says, he calls a consensus of scholarship that says that there are no dying and rising gods that predate the Christian era. He says, but I take exception with it. I think there are three and maybe as many as five. But he defines resurrection differently. It could mean any kind of a belief of life after death. And as one of his prime examples in the top three is Baal. And what you have with Baal is he's killed by his nemesis Mott. And the way they know that is because Baal's parents, it stopped raining, and Baal was the storm god, so it stops raining. And then so Baal's mother goes down and beats up Mott and tells him to get to vomit Baal. And he agrees to do it, so she goes up, and later on he vomits Baal, and all of a sudden, a few months later, Baal's dad says, hey, Baal, our son is alive. And the way he knew is because it was raining again. There was no appearance, and it happened in the dark, gray, distant, unnamed past. Again, this is far different, and Metinger points this out. He says, when you look at these dying and rising gods in antiquity, even the three, the five that I mentioned, there's no real dating assigned to it. There's rarely a post-mortem appearance. In just some cases, you know the person's still alive. And he admits that even of his five cases, a number of them are pretty ambiguous, and he has to strain a little bit to get them. Far different, he says, than what we have. And I'm not even sure this guy's a Christian, but he says when we come to Jesus, it happens within the lifetime of the eyewitnesses. They claim to see it. They're going around preaching it. And he says this distinguishes Christianity from any other of these religions. The riddle remains. There is a big difference between these and what we have with Christianity.
There is, and I agree with you. There's much more evidence for the resurrection than there are for other miracle stories from the ancient world, at least that I'm aware of. But let me see if I've got your historical method understood. Let's consider the story of the temple at Delphi. The historian Herodotus, who is much more interested with telling accurate history than the gospel writers, because he names his sources, he has extended explanations of his historical method, etc. And yet he tells the story of the Temple of Delphi defending itself with magical armaments and lightning bolts and collapsing cliffs as if it was just sober history. So are we saying that if we had, say, three or four contemporary accounts of that story scraps of writings from the ancient world, we don't have the original copies or any of that stuff, and they contradict each other at several different points, but we have a couple of witnesses who claim to be eyewitnesses to that account. If that was the evidence that we had for the Temple of Delphi, would we also accept that story under your historical criterion?
I think I'd be open to considering stuff, Luke. We'd have to look at it on an individual case-by-case basis. Mm-hmm. With Herodotus, he certainly states that, there are some really strange things that have happened at times. And he says, I'm just going to report these things, and I'll leave it up to the reader whether or not to believe them. And he shows credulity or incredulity at times toward some of the stories and says, well, I don't personally believe this, but I'm just going to report what's being said and let you, the reader, make up your mind. We could talk about those reports, but we would have to look at what is the actual evidence behind it. Bart Ehrman and I had a debate a few months ago, and he raised up the Marian apparitions at things like Medjugorje and some of the other places. And So, you know, what do you do with these? I said, well, I really hadn't looked at these at this point, but I'm not a Catholic, so I'm inclined to reject those a priori. But if I were going to look at them as a historian, I would have to look at the evidence for them and see, well, what does the evidence point to? And if the evidence point very strongly to Marian apparitions, that I would, as a historian, would have to be very open to that, to accepting those. And since I have looked at those since then, and you know, the Catholic Church has even admitted, well, we're not even certain if they're authentic. So that's the official position of the Vatican on it, even as of today. The evidence is not as strong as what we have for the resurrection in those things. So, yeah, if you want to look at the Temple of Delphi, we would have to consider what evidence there is for it and be open to it. And is what is presented in that one account, is that the best explanation? Is the evidence that strong? But again, with the resurrection of Jesus, what we have are multiple reports from people who claim to be eyewitnesses in individual and group settings, friend and foe alike. And that changes things. That's quite different when you look at it that way. If you throw in the empty tomb, if you throw in James, it even makes it stronger. When you throw in the predictions of Jesus about his claims to deity and his violent and imminent death and subsequent resurrection, you mount a pretty strong case and you say, we've got all these things, all these historical data that we're looking at here. What's the best way to account for all of these things? Jesus claimed to be divine. Jesus predicted his violent death and resurrection. Then we've got all these people in individual and group settings, friend and foe alike, who are saying that Jesus appeared to them. Man, I think that's putting together a pretty strong case. I'm not saying that it's airtight. I'm looking at and I'm comparing with the different criteria for the best explanation. And again, if you want to present a naturalistic explanation that we can look at, Luke, I'd be happy to do that. But when you weigh hypotheses, I mean, I've weighed a number of them. And for the ones I've looked at, the resurrection comes out on top every time, and it does so by a significant margin. And when we are looking at things, it's not a matter of just saying, well, it could have been this, it could have been that. You know, we could say that to anything. We've got to look at the best explanation, compare alternate hypotheses, and see which one comes out on top. So which one would you put, how would you explain that evidence? Let's form the Luke hypothesis. What would that be, Luke?
Well, I'd like to just make one other point before we get to my naturalistic explanations. We talked about how we really don't have as good of evidence for the Temple of Delphi story or other stories as for the resurrection of Jesus. But and that's, you know, a shame of the ancient world. It's just so distant. We don't have much evidence for any of them. But when we look to the contemporary modern world, we actually have a lot more evidence for recent miracle stories than we could possibly hope to have for something that happened 2,000 years ago, including the case of Jesus. Mm-hmm. For example, the dancing sun at Fatima, Portugal, supposedly witnessed by 70,000 people. We have newspaper clippings from that day. We have a photograph of the sky from that day. 70,000 people, or several witnesses from the 70,000, gave testimony that the sun danced around in the sky for a while and then careened towards the earth. And yet, I don't think most of us would agree that that actually happened, even though that's much better and much more recent evidence than we have from 2,000 years ago, a few manuscripts. The same would go for the Hindu milk miracle of 1985 in India, where hundreds of people claimed that the spirit of Ganesha was drinking milk from his statues all across India, and we have newspaper writings from it. We have people who've written on their websites about it. We have living witnesses in this case that we can go to and interview, and they can exactly tell their story to us. We have video evidence of this happening. You can watch it on YouTube.
Right.
And yet we don't actually think that the spirit Ganesha drank milk one day, just got thirsty for physical milk one day. So there are lots and lots of modern miracle claims that are much better attested than this case for Jesus, and yet we know to reject them because the inherent implausibility in the idea of an invisible spirit hanging around in shaped stone for thousands of years and then deciding one day that he wanted to drink physical milk and then never again. That hypothesis is so inherently implausible that it's way more likely, even if we have to say 100 people lied or were confused or were, you know, hallucinating, even that is way more likely than an invisible spirit hanging out for thousands of years in a statue and then deciding to drink milk one day. And that's obvious to most of us about these modern miracle claims. Why is that not obvious about the ancient evidence for Jesus, where all the witnesses are long dead? We don't even know if they were witnesses. They just claim to be witnesses. We don't have any of their original writings. We don't have any physical evidence existing at all anymore for that whole story. It's only the writings. And the accounts are contradictory, all these other problems. What would you say to that?
In terms of the accounts being contradictory, we could get in more into that and be happy to do that. I don't think that the differences in the peripheral details, and I do acknowledge that there are differences, but when we consider the genre in which the Gospels are written, and I really haven't used the Gospels tonight, but if we consider the genre in which the Gospels are written, in the resurrection narratives, I don't really see a problem with the differences that we have. Again, they're in the peripheral details. They do not impact the core. And I mean, you can go after the Gospels as much as you want and call them unreliable, but they are still reliable enough that they have convinced nearly a unanimous consensus of scholars today of those three facts. So those three facts still need to be accounted for. And things like when we come to Medjugorje, Fatima, things like that, I would say with the thing with the sun, again, I'd have to look into this a little bit more, but, I mean, we've all looked at the sun, and if you stare at it long enough, it's moving. Now, if you want to look at things on videotapes, look, if I had a spirit walking in front of me, and, you know, I look at this thing, and I say, whoa, that's a spirit. It's kind of translucent. I can see through it. It looks at me. It communicates with me. I see it going up to statues and drinking milk, and then it flies away. And I'm seeing that in a group of people, and I'm not the only one witnessing. Others are. I'm not going to turn around and say that that's a hallucination. I'm going to say something spiritual happened here. Now, what kind of interpretation am I going to give to this thing? Again, I'm not a naturalist. I'm open to these kinds of things. I think these are very difficult for some of them. I'm not talking about any of the ones in particular that you mentioned. Many of those I just haven't looked at. I'm being honest with you. So we have to look at them case by case. I'd have to spend some time looking at those and studying it and then assessing it as best as I could. But if I saw some of those things, I would have to look and say, well, what's the evidence for it? If the evidence is really good, I'm going to have to accept that some sort of a spiritual appearance has taken place. I might interpret it different than someone else, but I would still acknowledge that something real happened here. It wasn't just in my head, because others saw it as well. Now, I've seen some of the things, these sightings of Mary in contemporary times. I had someone who emailed me a photograph of the side of a building, like a mirror building down in Florida, and they said, wow, look at this, all these people gathered around. It's the Virgin Mary there. And don't you see it, Mike? Well, I see what you could construe as that, but it just looks like the mirrors are bent in such a way as to cause that. That's not impressive to me. You know, I've had a couple people send me things like that. Well, I'm not impressed by that. I'm more impressed by some of these other stories, like at Lourdes and Medjugorje and Fatima. I think that's interesting, but again, even given all the evidence, even the Vatican isn't willing to say that these were appearances of Mary. So I'd have to look at them one at a time, Luke, but I don't rule out the supernatural in those cases.
Okay. Yeah, I think we certainly have a different epistemology there. I think one problem with supernatural explanations is that there's no method for us to determine one prefer one supernatural explanation to another. When you just say that it's supernatural, which to me sounds the same as saying that it's magic, there's no way for us to say that it was God doing it, or Quetzalcoatl doing it, or invisible gremlins inside of each and every atom doing it by telepathic communication with each other.
But those are different issues, aren't they? I mean, when we're talking about the resurrection of Jesus, look, I'll be the first to admit, I can't prove, as a historian or otherwise, that God raised Jesus from the dead. You know, I'm going to make a judgment call on what I think happened. That's going to be judged largely or influenced largely by my worldview, but I can't say that it wasn't some sort of an alien doing a PhD project in a distant universe who, as an experiment, raised Jesus from the dead. Maybe he was an alien who came here and said he was God and or divine, and then he allowed himself to be killed, and then he raised himself from the dead and deceived everyone. I can't prove that that's not the case. But the question we're discussing really isn't what was the cause of Jesus' resurrection. I mean, of course, we're all interested in that if it occurred. But the question we're asking is, did Jesus rise from the dead?
Yeah, and I think one of the problems with our conversation is that we've come to opposite conclusions about the resurrection for reasons that we can never talk about all of them. You believe that the resurrection actually happened for lots of reasons in addition to what you're giving here. You've been mentioning James and some other, and I disbelieve in the resurrection for lots of reasons that I can't go into here. So that's going to be difficult, but at the end of the podcast, we'll recommend some other resources for people. But I thought maybe we could get to the naturalistic explanations.
Be happy to do that, but I do want to say one thing here. No, I believe the resurrection of Jesus based on looking at, based on historical method. I think we can show it. I don't want to confuse the cause of the resurrection. That's a different issue. But I do believe the supernatural, I think there's good enough evidence to show that the supernatural occurs, that a supernatural worldview in which some sort of supernatural activity happens within our universe, it happens on Earth, that's much more plausible outlook of reality than a naturalistic one that says that these things don't happen. I think there's just too much evidence to the contrary. When you place the evidence for the resurrection within that, or even just take a neutral position and say naturalism may or may not be false. We're not going to take a firm position on either one. Let's just be open to supernaturalism. Let's look at the evidence for the resurrection and see, let the evidence talk for itself, and where does it point to? And I think when you do that and you compare hypotheses, the resurrection hypothesis wins. And then it makes supernaturalism look a whole lot more plausible in that way. So that's all I wanted to add.
Yeah. And just to clarify for the listeners, I'll point out that I'm not arguing for naturalism. I'm certainly open to supernatural explanations. For example, dark matter and dark energy are almost by definition supernatural because they aren't baryonic matter and energy. So there are all kinds of things that can be completely outside our scope of what we would call the natural universe. I just haven't been convinced of the resurrection of Jesus being supernatural or, you know, Ganesha drinking milk and stuff like that. But I do have a preference for natural explanations because of the history that I've read and how they turn out to be much more useful and predictive explanations than supernatural ones do.
I think when a natural explanation can account for the data as well as a supernatural one, you got to prefer the natural. But when natural explanations fail, and the only plausible explanation that works is a supernatural one, I don't see why we got to reject that for a naturalism of the gaps.
Great. Well, that leads us right into naturalistic explanations for the resurrection.
Okay.
The way I see it is that, you know, you said when we've got natural explanations that explain the data or are more likely to be true than supernatural explanations, then we've got to go with the natural ones. And I agree. And I can think of actually quite a few natural explanations that are more likely. And here's why. Out of the, say, 10 billion people that have ever lived, I don't have good reason to believe that any of them have resurrected from the dead. And I have looked at near-death stories, and I'm not going to include Jesus in this because that's the one we're debating. So let's say, as a conservative estimate, that the chances of someone rising from the dead are 1 in 10 billion. Now, can I come up with another explanation that's more likely than that? That's not very difficult, I don't think. Even if the natural explanations are pretty tricky to fit with the historical data, I don't think it's going to be very difficult to come up with one that's more likely than 1 in 10 billion. For example, people will come together and lie, make up a story, or hear a story and build it up because it helps them emotionally or whatever, and become to believe things, very strange things, because of a charismatic leader telling them. They'll believe it very strongly, and this happens. This is actually something that we do know about. We know of many cults that are deceived by a charismatic leader into believing things. And they'll write their stories about how this, and they'll even make up stories, or they'll come to believe that stories that they were making up, they'll come to believe them as actually true. And we actually know of this happening in history. So it's pretty implausible, but we actually know that it happens. So it's more plausible than, I think, 1 in 10 billion. Could group hallucinations happen? This also has been documented.
Hang on a second. Let's deal with that one if we can first, and then we can move on. Let me ask you a question. You said, okay, 10 billion people, okay, let's say, have existed on the Earth, and as far as you know, none have been raised. I think, Luke, that this shows, and I would agree with you, the chances of someone rising from the dead by natural causes at zero. I just don't see it happening by natural causes. The difference is that no one has ever claimed that Jesus rose by natural causes. The claim is that God raised Jesus from the dead. If Jesus was who he claimed to be, then that changes things significantly. It's different than my grandfather dying in 1978 and then him not coming back to life. He never claimed to be divine. He never claimed that he was God's agent chosen to usher in his kingdom. He didn't predict his death and resurrection either. On the other hand, you got Jesus who did claim those things of himself. And the claim again is that God raised him from the dead. So I think when we look at probabilities, I'd like to suggest to you that you look at probabilities a little bit different for a moment. If we knew ahead of time that God does not exist, then we could say that the probability of Jesus rising from the dead is zero. But if we knew ahead of time that God exists and wanted to raise Jesus, then I think we could say that the probability of Jesus rising from the dead is about 100%. The challenge to us as individuals is, how do we know those antecedent probabilities? I don't think we can. I don't think you at this point would be prepared to argue that you know for a fact that God does not exist. And I cannot argue that I know for a fact with 100% certainty that God exists and wanted to raise Jesus. So, in terms of antecedent probabilities, I don't think that is very helpful here. And that's why, as historians, we've got to look at the data. We've got to bracket our worldviews, look at the data, let the data talk for itself. And then, if Jesus rose from the dead, we've got to go, whoa, that points to God then. Why did God want to raise Jesus from the dead? Wow, he made some pretty interesting claims about himself. So I just don't think that the 10 billion people analogy is a proper one.
Yeah, Mike, I'm glad you brought this up, because if I was absolutely certain that God existed, I still would not believe that Jesus rose from the dead. And I'll tell you why. You said that no one is claiming that Jesus rose from the dead naturally. Obviously, the chances of that are zero. But you say that you seem to indicate that it's somehow more likely if we say Jesus didn't rise from the dead naturally, God rose Jesus from the dead. And if I said that I just teleported here to LA from New York, the chances of that are zero because we have no experience of that ever happening. It breaks all the laws of physics and biology and everything just like a resurrection would. Now, if I said God teleported me here from New York to LA, how does that improve the chances that that actually happened? Would that make my story more believable?
Okay, now I think you misunderstood me, Luke. I said if we knew for a fact that God exists and wanted to raise Jesus, then that would make his resurrection enormously probable.
Yes, and I'm saying for this example, let's say I knew that God, let's say we both agreed that God existed. If I told you God
and wanted to raise Jesus, we knew ahead of time he wanted to raise Jesus.
Well, that part of the story comes from the people who already believe that he was resurrected and are telling us the story.
Yeah, but I'm saying in determining probabilities here, antecedent probabilities, the only, you know, in order to say that it's improbable that Jesus rose from the dead, because 10 billion people have died and not risen from the dead, I'm saying that if we knew ahead of time that God does not exist, and we don't, but if we did, then we could say antecedently, it's improbable that Jesus did not rise from, that Jesus rose from the dead. It's improbable. In fact, the probability is zero if God does not exist.
Mm-hmm.
And conversely, I'm saying, if we knew for a fact that God exists and wanted to raise Jesus, if we knew that, then the probability of Jesus' resurrection would be close to 100%. But I said, we don't know those things. So the only way that we can determine probabilities here is not with any background knowledge of that sort, not with antecedent probability. We've got to look at the data, bracket our worldviews, look at the data, and see where the data points. And my contention is when we use the tools of professional historians and weigh hypotheses and those criteria for the best explanation, resurrection comes out on top.
I still don't understand how it helps my case to say that we both know that God exists and God teleported me here from New York.
All right, if we knew ahead of time that God exists, desired and intended to teleport you from Los Angeles to New York, and then all of a sudden you're gone from Los Angeles and you're in New York, do I have reason to believe that God teleported you there?
Well, I guess the difference is that I wouldn't grant the knew ahead of time that he wanted to do that.
I wouldn't either.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that we know ahead of time that God exists and wanted to raise Jesus. I'm using as an argument against yours. I'm saying against the antecedent probability to look at the 10 billion people and to say, we know ahead of time that miracles are improbable. Well, the only way to say that it's improbable is to know ahead of time that God doesn't exist or did not want to raise Jesus from the dead. We don't know those things. Because I said, conversely, if God exists and wanted to raise Jesus from the dead, then the chances of him rising from the dead approaches 100%. But I'm saying we don't know those things.
Yeah.
So you can't say that it's antecedently probable or improbable that Jesus rose from the dead prior to looking at the data. The only way to determine probability when we come to history is to look at the data, weigh hypotheses, and wherever the data points, that is how we determine what's probable and what's improbable.
Wow.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, so maybe I misunderstood you, but it sounds like you just ruled out Bayesian reasoning in history.
Yeah, historians don't use Bayes' theorem, and they admit this. Check out C.B. McCollum in his book, Justifying Historical Descriptions. Check out David Bartholomew in his book, there's a number of different articles and books written by professional historians. You don't use Bayes' theorem. Why? Because we seldom have the background knowledge that is required in order to determine probability.
So the background knowledge that people don't generally rise from the dead is not useful in us determining whether or not Jesus rose from the dead?
No, it's not helpful at all, because People die. We don't expect them to come back. They die by natural causes. People aren't coming back from the dead by natural causes, ever. But Jesus is different, because it was Jesus who claimed to be divine, who claimed to be God's agent, chosen to usher in his kingdom, who predicted his death and resurrection. And if Jesus is who he claimed to be, and I'm not presupposing that he is, but I'm saying if he is who he claimed to be, and if God exists and wanted to raise him from the dead, then we approach nearly 100% probability that he rose from the dead.
You're saying that our consistent experience throughout all of human history of people not rising from the dead for natural or supernatural explanations, with the possible exception of Jesus, is not useful in helping us determine whether or not Jesus rose from the dead.
For natural explanations, yes. For supernatural explanations, no, I probably wouldn't agree with that, because there were three or four in the New Testament who were said to have been raised by Jesus or his disciples, and I'm not going to a priori rule those out. They weren't raised in the same way Jesus was, according to those reports. They were raised back to this sort of life, whereas Jesus was raised with a different sort of body, an immortal body, because he was the first fruits of the general resurrection. So, no, I wouldn't say necessarily by supernatural causes. I would say certainly, almost always, a person isn't going to come back by natural or supernatural causes. There's really no reason God would have for raising most people from the dead. But suppose he did have a reason. Suppose in the New Testament times, he allowed Jesus to raise people from the dead to add credibility to his ministry, or for the apostles as Christianity's getting kicked off the ground. And I'll be honest with you, I am not going to rule out that resurrections don't ever occur today. J.P. Moreland has been saying for years that he has investigated a number of accounts that happened in third world countries of people coming back to life, and he is convinced that resurrections occasionally occur today with Christians raising the dead. But it's in specific instances where it would certainly impact the credibility of Christianity at that point. So there's a context that occurs in which it's possible. Now, I have not investigated any of those myself, and I'll be honest with you, even though it was J.P. Moreland, who I know is a very critical thinker, is not gullible, is very careful, I still have my pause. I wouldn't say that they never happen, even by supernatural causes, to individuals. But I would say, by and large, 99.9999% of the time, it doesn't happen even by supernatural causes to individuals. The fact that you've had, use your number, 10 billion people, and say 10 billion people have not risen from the dead by natural causes or supernatural causes, we'll just bracket the few instances in which Keener and Moreland say they're open to them occurring in some third world countries that they know of. Bracket those, because there are only a few of them. Bracket the ones from the New Testament that are reported, because we're not going to assume general reliability in Acts or the Gospels. And let's just look at the resurrection of Jesus one and say 10 billion people who have died and not risen from the dead. I don't think that has any relevance whatsoever to Jesus, because the claim is not that Jesus came back to life by natural causes. The claim is that he came back by supernatural ones. And if Jesus is who he claimed to be, and God wanted to raise him to vindicate those claims, then I think that we are approaching 100% probability that it would occur. And again, I'm not assuming that it was who he claimed to be, or that God wanted to raise him. I'm just saying, probability-wise, if you grant those things, you're near 100% probability. But forget that. I'm saying we just have to look at the evidence itself and say, weigh the hypotheses. Which one is the best hypothesis? That's the one you got to go with.
We disagree about resurrections happening in history, so I think I'll use a different example. Would you agree then that the fact that we have never encountered teleportation happening naturally and never encountered it happening supernaturally, that background information is not useful in us in looking at my claim that I just teleported here from New York.
If we knew ahead of time, Luke, and I'm saying ahead of time, if we knew that God exists, wanted to teleport you from California to New York, and intended to do so, and all of a sudden, the reports are that you are gone from California, and that you are in New York. Even if we had no claim in the past of that happening, even if we had no conception of how that might have happened by natural cause, if we knew ahead of time that that is what happened, that God wanted to teleport you, I see no reason to say that that would be improbable. Now, let's bracket the question of God here. And let's say that you're in California, and I'm out there with you. And you say, I'm going to teleport myself from California to New York. And I say, oh, I got a friend in New York, David Wood. Where are you going to teleport yourself to, Luke? Well, I'm going to teleport myself to Fordham University. Great, that's where David is finishing up his PhD work. Where are you going to do it? Well, I'm going to do it in the cafeteria. That's where I'm going to end up. Okay, I'm going to have David standing there. And I call David up. All right, David says, okay, I'm in the cafeteria. And I said, all right, Luke, you say you're going to teleport yourself. Go for it, buddy. And all of a sudden, you vanish from my presence, and then David calls me on my cell phone and says, Mike, you're not going to believe this. He's here. Well, you either pulled a David Copperfield on me, or you actually did it. And if I look at the different explanations and say, okay, you know, gosh, I did a blood test on him here. David did a blood test there that matches up. I'm going to believe that you teleported yourself.
Well, for one, people like David Copperfield actually have done things like that. Maybe not with the whole blood test thing, but that would be my first guess. Now, if it turned out that we had, you know, blood tests and all that kind of stuff, then that would be really spooky, and I would, oh my gosh, you know, maybe this is some kind of weird, maybe there's aliens here that are doing this, maybe there's some kind of supernatural being that wants to trick us, maybe Yahweh did it, maybe Quetzalcoatl did it, maybe this guy has never been a human at all, maybe we both hallucinated, but all of those options are incredibly improbable, and so I would be just pretty dumbfounded at that point.
You'd have to be open to teleportation then, wouldn't you?
Oh, absolutely, and I am today. But it is incredibly improbable, just like it's incredibly improbable that Yahweh would want to teleport someone, or that aliens are here and want to teleport someone, or any of that.
Well, we don't have any kind of evidence to show that that would be the case.
No, yeah.
We do have evidence for the resurrection, though.
Well, we have some evidence for the resurrection. It's much better than evidence for Apollonius, but it's much worse for evidence that we have of modern miracle claims. I think our epistemology is very different. When something is claimed to have happened and it contradicts everything that we know and everything that we experience, regardless of our background beliefs about whether supernatural or natural is possible, that actually has an effect on how I evaluate those claims.
I appreciate you saying that. Let me give you another example. Let's suppose that, let's take a guy who's 50 years old. He's an atheist. He's always been an atheist. He was born blind, been married. And on a Saturday afternoon, he and his wife decide to take a walk. So they're walking down the street hand in hand. And at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, for some reason, unknown reason, he all of a sudden gets his eyesight. And he goes to a friend of his who is a leading eye doctor. And they do some eye tests, and the guy says, this is just remarkable. I've got no medical explanation for this. Now you ask yourself, you say, is that a miracle? Well, maybe yes, maybe no. It could be an anomaly. Maybe the neurons in his head after 50 years just kind of connected and I wouldn't say that's a miracle. Well, let's just change the details of that story a little bit. Say, same guy, 50 years old, atheist, never prayed for his eyesight, born blind, walking down the street, 1 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon with his wife, and a stranger walks up to him out of nowhere and says, "In the name of Jesus, you will now see," and walks away. And at the very moment he said that and starts walking away, the guy gets his eyesight. Now he goes to the doctor, his friend, and says, "What's going on?" The guy says, "I've got no medical explanation for this." Are we justified at that point in saying that a miracle occurred? What do you think, Luke?
There are some other possibilities. Magical explanations are certainly possible, but...
Magic, what are you referring to?
Well, I think of
magic... It's an ambiguous term.
Well, I think I use the word magic to mean the same thing that you mean by supernatural, something that has no natural explanation, and it's just basically through the sheer will of some agent.
Of the guy who said, "In the name of Jesus, you'll see."
Sure, or
it was through his will. Even though the atheist didn't believe in that stuff, it was the will of the agent who said that that caused him to see?
Yeah, I'm saying that it could be. It could be a magical explanation.
You can't prove anything, any explanation, with 100% and absolute certainty. So I'm asking you, as a rational person, forget the possibilities, okay? Consider all the different possibilities if you like, but do you think, in that case, in the second case, that the guy walks up and says, "In the name of Jesus, you'll now see," and boom, he gets a sight. At that point, no medical explanation. Are we rationally justified in concluding that a miracle happened there?
I think there are several possibilities here that all are equally likely or unlikely. For example, let's say that we went back in time just 50 years and started using an iPhone to somebody there. Or, you know, maybe 150 years, however you want to do it.
Right, or just take ice down to a remote tribe in the Amazon. You know, they've never seen ice or refrigerators. So I understand what you're saying there.
Right.
It's not about what I'm saying we don't know. It's what we do know about science. And in our culture, modern culture, this guy just walks up out of nowhere and says that and then walks away. The guy has a sight.
Well, I think we're very aware in our modern culture that there's an awful lot that we don't know. And so the chances that this is someone who has a very superior technology or is very skilled at mentalism or illusions, even is an alien. I mean, those things are all extremely improbable in this case. But I think they're just as probable as, I don't even know what you're arguing for, but maybe,
I don't think it is as probable. I'd be open to those things that you say as possibilities. Can't rule them out.
Mm-hmm.
Say an alien or whatever. Or some individual with advanced psychic powers causing those things to happen. I'm not going to rule those things out. But I think that the context that we have is so charged with religious significance, we got to pay attention to that. And I think that that changes the situation. When if the guy just gets his eyesight, wow, that's something. But when it happens in that context that's charged with religious significance, such as the guy walking up and saying, "In the name of Jesus, you'll now see," and boom, at that point, I think we need to listen to that at that point and say, wow. Could it be that this guy was healed through the name of Jesus, that God wanted it to happen at that point as a sign to that atheist and a message to the atheist that God is trying to break through the intellect and communicate with this guy to show that he's real? I think we've got to be open to that. And when it comes to the resurrection of Jesus, we've got that kind of context, is what I would argue. We've got Jesus who comes on this scene. Virtually every historical Jesus scholar acknowledges that at absolute minimal, Jesus thought of himself and proclaimed himself to be God's agent who was chosen to usher in his kingdom, and that he performed deeds which his followers, regarded as miracles and exorcisms, and that his skeptics said, "Well, this is pretty amazing stuff. We don't believe it's miracles. Demonic or sorcery or something, but whoa, these are some really cool things he's doing." So he's claiming to be God's agent. He's performing deeds that he and his disciples claim are miracles and exorcisms. He predicts his death and resurrection. And then all the evidence we have afterwards points to his resurrection. I'm saying that the context of Jesus' claims about himself and his predictions that creates a context that is charged with religious significance that makes it much more probable or plausible that Jesus was who he claimed to be and that he was actually raised from the dead than to say that an alien did it. Or that there were some psychic powers involved that caused him to be raised from the dead. Natural psychic powers. We can believe what we want. It becomes more than just an academic exercise there. It becomes one of the will, I think, and what we want to believe. And maybe I am guilty of allowing that want to influence me more to believe in the resurrection. In fact, I would admit that that is the case. We're all biased in a sense. But what I don't want to do, Luke, is to be so skeptically minded that it comes to a point where there is absolutely nothing, no amount of evidence that could convince me that Jesus actually rose from the dead and was who he claimed to be. There comes a point where we say, okay, this intellectual academic stuff is fun. I do it for a living. I love it. I'm hooked on it. But then there's a deeper question in each of us that says, I want to go beyond this. I want it to be more than just an academic exercise. It's more than just fun and a game. I want to know truth. What is it that I really believed happened to Jesus? Man, this context is really interesting about his claims. He predicts his resurrection. All the evidence we have points to it. And when I compare this with naturalistic explanations, which you're going to come at me with some more, he said, but it's getting down, what is it for our own personal interest? What do we really think happened here? We have to go more beyond possibilities, and there is a point where we stop. And like I said, when it comes to the resurrection of Jesus, hey, I got to say, I think that historically speaking, we can prove with adequate certainty that Jesus rose from the dead. And when I say prove, it's based on the information we now have and weighing it according to our current logical processes of what's the best explanation, how we arrive at historical knowledge. Okay, so we look at that with reasonable, adequate certainty. We can show Jesus rose from the dead. But I can't prove God did it. I can't prove that he wasn't an alien. Well, then when I compare the alien hypothesis with, say, Jesus claims to be who he was, and the context in which all this occurs, I don't want to play games with that. Is it really rational to believe that Jesus was who he claimed to be? Could this guy change my life? Could this impact my eternity? I want to go beyond. I'm not saying in this discussion, I'm just challenging you and all listeners, let's go beyond just the mere inquiry and make it a heart issue as well. Not just of the head, but of the heart. Say, wow, could this stuff be true? And if it is, what does that mean in my life? And did Jesus really rise from the dead? If he did, do I want to believe he's an alien who pulled a cosmic joke on us? Or what if he was who he claimed to be?
Well, I guess there I would just say that I don't think that it's wise to think with the heart. I don't think that feeling or existential angst-type approaches are good ways to find out what is actually true about the universe. And to sum up what I've been trying to say throughout the interview and where I'm coming from is that we do have much better evidence for the resurrection of Jesus than we do for other miracles that claim to have happened in the past. But for me, it's far, far short of what we would need to believe that a resurrection actually happened and that Jesus walked through walls and flew up into the sky and everything.
Walk through walls and flying in the sky, those are peripheral details in the Gospels. They're not part of our relevant historical bedrock. And I would say that when we're looking at it as a historian, we can't consider those. We've got to bracket those peripheral details. I might believe those, but I would admit that those are just by faith. I am open to the possibility of there being legend in the Gospels. I would not rule that out. I'm not saying that there is, but I'm certainly open to it. So if that's the case, that still wouldn't, let's say that him walking through the walls and the ascension as described in Acts were legend, later put in there. Let's say the earthquake and the six phenomena reported at Jesus' death on Friday afternoon were legend. They were poetic devices inserted in there. Let's say that the gospel authors didn't accurately remember how many angels there were at the tomb, or their posture, were they sitting or standing, and so forth, and where they were when they spoke to the women. Let's say that they got some of those wrong. I'm not saying that happened, I'm just saying let's say that they got it wrong. Some of them had faulty memory. That doesn't at all change the fact that there were, say, two angels, and that they were there at the tomb. They met the women. They told the women, he's not here, he's risen. Missing out on some of the peripheral details does nothing to challenge the core of the account, which is part of the relevant historical bedrock.
Yeah, so I'm fine with that. I can restate what I've been saying then. Just talking about the resurrection, to sum up my whole argument basically is that if we use our common sense and ask, is the evidence that we have for the resurrection of Jesus, which is thousands of years old and there's certainly lots of problems with it, is that good enough to believe that, contrary to everything we know and have experienced and have learned through science, that somebody actually rose from the dead? And I think not. And I think if people think about this in a way that is contemporary and makes sense to them, like if 20 people came to you and told them that there was, an invisible dragon in their garage and wrote books about this invisible dragon and all this kind of thing, I don't think we would believe them. And I don't think that we should believe these ancient writers who told their stories about resurrection and all these other possibly legendary things either.
Well, I guess I would just take issue with that, and I'd say I do think it is strong enough, and I've provided reasons why. If we go by historical method, I think historical method shows that it is sufficient, that it is the best explanation by far. So let's get back to your alternative hypothesis so that we can compare it. I don't think I've heard one yet.
Sure. Well, as I was saying before, to me, the chances or the likelihood of supernatural resurrection is extremely low. And to come up with naturalistic explanations that are difficult, but still more likely than resurrection is pretty easy. Certainly, we could have had a charismatic Jesus who did Copperfield-like tricks to gain followers.
Okay, so now I want to be clear, and for myself, and I want you to be clear for me and mm-hmm. the listeners. Is this what you think happened?
Oh, I don't claim at all to know what happened.
Okay, so let's do this. You don't claim to know what happened.
Yes.
You've got to have a hypothesis, though, of what you think happened.
Well, honestly, I don't think that I do. I think that I don't know is a perfectly rational and justified choice.
I would agree with that. But my thing is, I would say, my contention is, if we look at the data and we apply historical method to it, resurrection comes out as the best explanation. I explained why with the explanatory scope, explanatory power.
Mm-hmm.
All right, explains all the facts, does so without any strain whatsoever. Now, how about if we come up with an alternative hypothesis, and let's go with that, and let's compare it. Or if you just want to say, I don't think we've got enough, you're welcome to stay with that, and we can talk about that some more.
Sure. I don't claim to know, as I said before, but I'll just pick one out of many that I think is more likely to have happened than the supernatural resurrection.
Okay.
And it's the one I started to give just a minute ago. I think that it's possible that a charismatic leader who did very impressive things and said very impressive things got a gang of followers together who really believed his stuff, and when he was killed by the Romans, they were so heartbroken that they, saw visions or hallucinations of Jesus after his death, kind of like, people who were so into Elvis that they saw Elvis after he died.
Yep.
And they started telling stories, and they started confirming each other, and the stories, grew, and we can see the story growing in the Gospels into more and more legendary, more and more theological stories. And that's how this whole movement began, and people really, believed that it was true. And so I think that's one of many possibilities that is more likely to have happened than a supernatural resurrection.
Okay. Let's look at that then. Let me restate it, make sure that I understand you properly.
Sure.
Jesus is this charismatic leader, does some really cool stuff, gets some followers. After he's killed, his followers, shocked, grief-stricken, hallucinated, appearances of the risen Jesus. They told these stories about the appearances, their experiences. The stories grew, and that began the Christian movement.
Sure, yeah.
Okay. Now, does that account for Jesus' death by crucifixion?
That was that's part of my story right there, where he died.
Yep, I agree with you. It accounts for it perfectly. What about number two? Does it account for why the disciples, in individual and group settings, had experiences that they interpreted as the risen Jesus appearing to them?
Well, interestingly enough, we don't actually know that that's the case, but what our evidence is that we have those stories from the Christian evangelists, and that is the story that they were telling. And
so are you denying the second fact then?
Let's go both ways. Let's say, for the first example, that I don't accept that fact, and that instead I think it was a story that was made up by this group of people who kept telling these stories, and the stories kept growing, because the Gospels come a couple of generations after.
Yeah, but Paul's much earlier than that. Paul is much earlier than the Gospels. And he's including oral tradition and peppered all throughout his letters. The most famous would be 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verses 3 through 7, which he states as oral tradition that had been passed down to him. Most scholars, I mean, we're even talking about the radical fellows of the Jesus Seminar, who never saw a saying of Jesus that they liked. and they grant that Paul received this tradition from the disciples, the Jerusalem apostles, no more than 5 years after the crucifixion. In fact, Robert Funk, the late co-founder of the Jesus Seminar, very skeptical, said 2-3 years, within 2 to 3 years is when Paul received this from the Jerusalem apostles, Peter. And we look and we see Paul's use of tradition throughout the New Testament and within his letters. We could talk about, I don't want to get off track here, that gets us into a more lengthy thing, but most scholars, most of them, the large majority, almost a unanimous consensus, say that Paul received this tradition from the Jerusalem apostles within 2 to 3 years, no more than 5 years after the crucifixion of Jesus. So we're not talking about 30 to 65 years after the death of Jesus. Now we're talking within 5 years and from the purported eyewitnesses themselves. And we've got Paul's eyewitness account on at least 3 occasions that Jesus appeared to him. Within his own writings, within the undisputed letters of Paul, I'm not talking about 1 Timothy, I'm not talking about Acts, I'm talking about 3 occurrences within the undisputed letters of Paul where Paul claims that Jesus appeared to him. And I'm talking about oral tradition that dates back very early and can be traced to the eyewitnesses, the Jerusalem apostles themselves. Put those two together, now we got eyewitness testimony from multiple sources, and they're very early.
Right. I do think that the resurrection story was very early. You know, maybe a couple of years at most after the death of Jesus. And what I was trying to say with the Gospels is that this story, we see evolution of the story and embellishment of the story in the Gospels.
I don't think we see as much as most people think, but if you want to cite some, and you know, but that, I don't think that's important. But
yeah,
if
that's
you
not
want
really
to, you're
important.
Welcome to go with it.
But a few, in any case, a few years are plenty of time for this kind of legendary development, and I'm sure you have lots of arguments against that.
Sure.
But we see contemporary legends popping up just as quickly.
Absolutely, and it certainly could pop up with things like resurrection. I mean, hey, we saw it happen later on. Let's say the Gospel of Peter, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where you got a walking, talking cross come out of the tomb,
yes.
And you got 2 angels holding Jesus, and their heads are going up to the clouds, and Jesus' head's going above the clouds, and then the cross talks. So, yeah, we see legend happening later on.
Yeah,
but,
so let's,
and it can happen within weeks. I would grant that as well.
Great.
But you do have Paul, who was a skeptic, who converts because he believes Jesus appeared to him. let's just say, and Crossan and Jonathan Reed in their book on Paul says, hey, we think you take Acts' account of Paul's conversion over anything else. They like that. So I'm like, whoa. Or I'm sorry, they bracket that, and they think Paul had an experience where he saw a bodily raised Jesus, because they think his language is so strong on that. So let's just bracket some of that and say, all right, Paul believes that he saw the risen Jesus, and he converts as a result. I don't think anybody would really would you dispute that?
I think that, I guess I'm less certain about pretty much everything in history, especially ancient history, than it appears that the scholarly community is. You know, even skeptical scholars are saying, you know, we're 80% sure about some particular fact, and I think we're much less sure than all of that about everything. So I think it's possible that this is the story that Paul is telling. I think it's quite possible, probably more likely than not, that that Paul actually believes that he had an experience of Jesus, the spirit of Jesus or something.
Okay, that's fair. That's fair. What about the disciples?
Sure. So the disciples, you know, we could go one path and I could say, well, maybe it was, you know, this was the story that they were telling. After all, what we know of the disciples and what their claims were and how determined they were in their faith is from Christians. All of the writings about all of these subjects are Christian. There are a couple non-Christians that mention names but don't really say anything about what was going on. So it's certainly possible that early Christian writers were, you know, telling these stories, and maybe many of them even believed them. But we certainly know of cases of cults in the modern era where, you know, this kind of, they start to believe their own lies. People who study cults document this. And so that's one possibility. I'm not saying it happened. I'm saying, again, I don't know, which is my favorite answer for pretty much everything. But then let's say that the disciples actually did believe that they experienced the resurrection of Jesus and that they weren't making these stories up, which is also possible. If that's the case, then I think that it's at least plausible that they, you know, had hallucinations.
We know that group hallucinations of that sort do not occur. A guy named Gary Sipsey, he's a licensed clinical psychologist. He's got a PhD in clinical psychology. And he checked through the literature of professional psychologists and said he did not find a single article over the last 30 years, 40 years, that talked about, in fact, he didn't, that's all I looked. He couldn't find a single one, period, where it was postulated within the professional literature of psychology that group hallucinations have occurred.
What I meant to say is that I think that they probably each had hallucinations, some of them, and then they share their stories. Hey, you know, I had this experience, and I know Jesus is alive, and all this kind of stuff. And then, you know, somebody who maybe had a very different and maybe much weaker, you know, psychological phenomena, you know, was like, oh yeah, I experienced Jesus as well, and wow, that's amazing. He's risen. You know, all this kind of stuff. Our dreams aren't crushed. This is, you know, he actually is real, and you know, his spirit is with us, or whatever they believed at that point in time.
That's not what was claimed, and it doesn't accord with what was claimed. If you go back to that early tradition in 1 Corinthians 15, and that is the biggie that all the scholars really refer to, because it's the toughie. It's the toughest thing to address. Paul gets this from the Jerusalem apostles, and it's what it says. It says he appeared to Peter, then he appeared to the 12. So now we have a group appearance. Then he appeared to more than 500 at one time. And then Paul puts in a parenthetical statement that says, most of whom have died, but most of whom have since died, but some are still alive. In other words, they're still alive as you can talk with them, cross-examine them. So this was a second group appearance. Then he appeared to James. Then he appeared to all the apostles. So and then Paul adds his own comments as, then lastly, he appeared to me. So we've got three group appearances, and three individual appearances at minimum. And this is the earliest tradition we have and comes from Paul and the Jerusalem apostles. So it won't do to say that they each saw Jesus because there were three group appearances. And we don't get this from the Gospels. I'm not taking this from the Gospels. I'm getting it from the earliest traditions that the majority of scholars, even skeptical ones, trace back to the Jerusalem apostles within 5 years.
What I'm saying is that these hallucinations happened individually, and then the story grew, which wouldn't have taken very much time at all. And so a couple years later, we have the story is, oh, he appeared to 500 people over here and all the disciples over here, and Thomas put his hand right through Jesus' hand. I thought it was amazing. And that's, you know, completely ad hoc, because I have no evidence that that's actually what happened. But I think that that is certainly possible given what we know about how cults start and what happens with strong beliefs and that kind of thing, and that is more probable than that an invisible God supernaturally changed the chemistry and biology going on in the body of Jesus Christ and reanimated his body and put it back together and started his blood pumping again and resurrected him from the dead. I do think it's more probable than that. And so that's my basic state, and that's what I would say for lots of other naturalistic hypotheses, where they're improbable, but not as improbable as an invisible being reanimating a body and bringing it back to life.
I would agree with you that legend occurs many times throughout history. I'm not even ruling out that legend has occurred within the Gospels, but I would rule it out as extremely unlikely when we come to this tradition and these early oral traditions that are preserved in Paul's writings. When you consider Jewish culture and the oral traditions then, and people like Birger Gerhardsen and others have written on the value of oral tradition within Jewish culture, ancient Jewish culture, they did not take and think of themselves as having the liberty to change those kinds of things and create those kinds of things. For example, Gerhardsen points out that in the ancient Jewish literature, there was one rabbi who was making up his own tradition. And he got rebuked from other rabbis because he's saying, you can't do this. Tradition has to come out of Jerusalem. It cannot be changed. It cannot be altered. Now, Paul was a Pharisee before he converted to Christianity. And Pharisees were very, very strict and very, very highly valued tradition, oral tradition. In fact, Jesus in Mark, I think it's Mark 7, might be Mark 5, but I think it's Mark 7, talked about how the Pharisees were so strong on tradition that they even placed its value above the scriptures at times. Now, when we come and we see how did Paul use tradition, and you look throughout his letters, he makes statements like, hold firmly to the tradition you received from me. If anyone departs from the tradition we passed along to you, don't even associate with such a person. And you're going, whoa, okay, well, he highly values it, but how do we know he wasn't making it up and he wanted people to follow it? Then we look at how Paul practiced what he preached. You go to 1 Corinthians chapter 7, and we see a beautiful example of this. We see Paul, and he's talking about to the Corinthians who are undergoing persecution at this point, and he says, hey, if you're married, you wrote me about this, and here's what I'm saying. My advice to you, if you're single, don't get married at this point, because if you get married, given the kind of persecution you all are enduring, it could really hurt you. You or your wife could be dragged off and executed right before your eyes. And you're going to be more concerned about your spouse at this point than God and standing firm in your faith. So I'm trying to save you guys for this. This isn't a command. I'm just giving you my own personal opinion. It's in your best interest to stay single while you're going through this persecution. Now, then he transitions. He says, to those of you who are married, not I, but the Lord said this. So now he distinguishes between his opinion and then he's talking about, you know, you need to stay married don't get divorced if you're married, because if you do and you marry someone else, you're committing adultery. And he's given the tradition of Jesus, and this comes, you can read it in Matthew, you can read it in Mark. So it's coming from Jesus. And then he says, okay, now, let me address another issue. I think it was like, what if the person you're married to is a non-believer and they want to leave? Okay, you can do this. He says, not the Lord, but I. And then after he says his instruction, he says, and this is my command to you, pass it along to the churches. So three different situations here. Paul says, first one, this is my opinion. Second, this isn't me, this is the Jesus tradition. Third, Jesus really didn't mention this in his teachings. So this is apostolic command I'm giving you, but it's not Jesus tradition, this is me. I'm not going to add, I'm not to the Jesus tradition, I'm not going to alter it, because that has to stay exactly how it is. This is the way what Jesus taught, and even though it would be expedient or helpful for me to appeal to Jesus and change that tradition, no, I can't do that, but I am giving you an apostolic command. So we find Paul, he refuses to change the Jesus tradition. He knows Jesus has appeared to him. He's holding firm to that. When it comes to the teachings, though, he's got this tradition he holds firmly. He's received it from the Jerusalem apostles. They're the eyewitnesses. So now you're going to have to go back to them and say, they changed it. They lied. They made these things up, even though they were eyewitnesses. And as they're creating this tradition, are they really, as first century Jews, pious Jews, going to feel the kind of liberty to just make up these kinds of things about someone who they truly believe rose from the dead? I think that that's very unlikely. And I don't know many scholars who would say that that's what occurred either. They're going to hold firmly that this is what the disciples actually believed, that Jesus appeared to them risen from the dead in individual and group settings. Now, a lot of scholars are going to reject it. They're going to say they were hallucinating, they experienced an altered state of consciousness or whatever you want to call it, but they believed in group settings that Jesus appeared to them. They saw him, and they spoke with him. They got his words. So it's going to be hard to get away with that one, Luke.
You're right, that the chances that somebody like Paul would break with tradition and that people would make up stories and it would grow, you know, into group hallucination stories so quickly is very improbable, like less than 0.01%. But for me, that is several orders of magnitude greater than the possibility or than the probability that an invisible being reanimated dead flesh into life, living flesh. And I know we disagree about that because our background theories about how the universe works is different, and there's lots of data and information that neither of us have time to go into here. But that's where I'm coming from. And I do want to talk, too, about most of what you said tonight is based on what the majority of scholars say, and that's because we don't have time to go into the details. So we're using scholars as a shortcut to the evidence.
Yeah, and I want to be clear, we shouldn't believe it because scholars believe it.
Yes.
What I'm saying that is, if we're going to build a hypothesis, we got to build it on that historical bedrock. And in order to qualify for that, and I think it's important we do it because it minimizes our bias, the impact of our bias. We all have biases. You've got it, I've got it, we all do. Nobody is exempt from it. And so we have to take steps. Deliberate steps to manage that bias mm-hmm. from it impacting us in negative ways as much as possible. And so for me, there's much more that I believe than I will grant within my or use within my argument for the resurrection.
Mm-hmm.
But I put a limit on what I'm using for the relevant historical bedrock. So that helps manage my bias because I'm knowing that even if atheists who have a dog in the fight. In fact, I shouldn't say that being from Atlanta. But even atheists who have their own reasons for wanting to deny the resurrection, if they're granting that these same three facts and saying the evidence is strong enough for these three facts, then I got to say, well, yeah, my bias does guide me some. I mean, theirs is guiding them as well, and we're all coming to the same conclusion, at least regarding these three facts.
Well, and what I was going to say is that, unfortunately, bias is extremely inherent to any statement when we say the majority of New Testament scholars, because both you and I know that the vast majority of New Testament scholars are and always have been Christian. It's kind of like...
Oh, that's false. That is not even close to being true. All you have to do is show up for the Society of Biblical Literature, which happens once a year. And, I mean, probably 4,000 scholars show up for that. 4,500 scholars show up for that every year. And you'll see that the vast majority of New Testament scholars are not Christians. Now, some may call themselves Christians, and I don't want to judge here or get into that. But then you'd say, well, what's a Christian? But if you got someone who says, no, I don't believe Jesus performed miracles, I don't believe he rose from the dead, I don't believe he was who he claimed to be, you know, does that qualify you still to be called a Christian? I would disagree with you, and I would say the vast majority, strong majority of New Testament scholars, I would say, are not Christians. And I would say a lot of them would claim not to be Christians. Gary Habermas has read about 2,500 different resources since 1975, between 600 and 800 scholars. And so he's actually done some bean counting. And I can say that in my doctoral research, hey, my dissertation bibliography, most of those sources I read, my bibliography is, I think, 67 pages single-spaced. And I can tell you from my readings that I would say the majority of the New Testament guys I've read are non-Christians.
Well, you've made a very good case, not one that has convinced me, but certainly a very strong case. And, of course, the listeners will have to decide. There's lots of stuff that we couldn't possibly have a chance to talk about. Are there some resources that you would recommend that listeners look into?
Yeah. I would say one of the most interesting and challenging books that I read in my research on the resurrection was the 2005 book, Resurrecting Jesus, by Dale Allison. And he denies the bodily resurrection of Jesus, but what makes it so interesting is he is not a naturalist. He doesn't believe that there's a reason for a bodily resurrection. And there's some other reasons I could go into as well that he rejects it. But he turns to apparitions of the dead, which he said he's actually experienced and that they're well documented in the literature. Apparitions of the dead as perhaps providing some insights of what happened with Jesus. The guy shows, listen, there's a lot I disagree with him with. But the guy shows a great awareness that he has personal bias. I think he's very humble in that way. It's very refreshing. You can tell that he is extremely well acquainted with the literature that is not only recent, but also 100 years old. This guy has really done his research, and I think he's done one of the best treatments of what happened to Jesus out there. Of course, N.T. Wright's book, The Resurrection of the Son of God, I think is an excellent book. I don't know that his actual case for the resurrection is the best out there. I think Gary Habermas and Bill Craig have probably done the best job of that stuff. But Wright does do a good contribution in discussing the views of the afterlife in antiquity. I would refer readers to, I think I referred to a little earlier, The Riddle of Resurrection by T.N.G. Mettinger in 2001. Some really good stuff in it in terms of dying and rising gods in antiquity and the evidence for it. And he's a pretty sober historian himself. Again, I don't think he's a Christian, he does some pretty good work with his history. Geza Vermesh came out with a book earlier this year called The Resurrection. He's a Jewish scholar. He does not believe Jesus rose from the dead. He does acknowledge a number of things, and I think in the end he just throws up his arms and he says, gosh, you know, I don't want to believe in resurrection, but this is pretty interesting stuff. I just don't know what happened. Pincus Lapid, another Jewish scholar, wrote a book called The Resurrection of Christ, and he makes a real interesting statement at the end. I mean, he rejects Jesus as the Messiah, but he said, gosh, you know, understanding the difference between Pharisees and Sadducees. Pharisees believe in bodily resurrection. Sadducees don't believe in a life after death. He said, I have always been a Pharisee when it comes to resurrections from the dead. when it came to Jesus' resurrection, I used to be a Sadducee. He says, I can no longer say that. And he accepts the resurrection of Jesus. I think that's kind of interesting. And William Lane Craig's book, Assessing the New Testament Evidence for the Historicity of the Resurrection of Jesus, a phenomenal book. Love it. It's got so many good things in it. Gary Habermas's book, The Risen Jesus and Future Hope, Roman and Littlefield. Excellent book. Has a concise case for the resurrection. A lot, but some really important results of his massive bibliographic research, where scholars stand and what they're saying and lists of who believe what on a few different things. Really good stuff in there. So I think those are some really good books that I would recommend that I think provide some good challenges, good interactions. I think some of the best stuff out there written on the resurrection right now.
Well, that's fantastic. There's a lot out there to learn and to digest. Do you have any final thoughts for people who are looking into this question and trying to decide what they think is true?
I would say to listeners that this whole question about what happened with Jesus and his fate, did he rise from the dead? What really happened? This is a significant question. It's not easy. When we look into these religious kinds of things that impact our metaphysics, our worldview, our horizons, our biases, our upbringing, our cultural conditioning, what school we went to, the influential people in our life, this all plays a very significant part in our investigation. It's something that we just can't get rid of. But we can take deliberate attempts to minimize our bias. I don't expect anyone to believe that what I did was successful in terms of minimizing or managing my own bias. Just as anyone who says that they did their best to manage their bias, if they have a conclusion that differs from my own, you know, I'm going to be skeptical of that. I do read certain writings. I do think that Dale Allison makes a very honest attempt to minimize his bias. Mettinger, I think, does that. I think outside of that, there are very, very few scholars on either side of the theological, philosophical spectrum that really do that. And I'd say there are apologists, Christian apologists out there. They're thinking more of trying to defend their faith than they are arriving at what actually occurred. But your listeners, they've got to determine for themselves, do I really want to know the truth? And if so, what kind of price am I willing to pay in order to get the truth? My contention is that I have wrestled through this. I'm not saying perfectly, but I have wrestled with this. And it's very difficult. It's agonizing. It takes years. If you're willing to go through that and do your best to manage your own bias, I think you can come up with some really interesting results. I've been humbled in some of the things that I used to believe, but I do believe. And having been willing to give up my faith, I do believe that the evidence very conclusively points to the resurrection of Jesus. It is our responsibility as historians to consider what the evidence would look like if we were not wearing our metaphysical bias like a pair of sunglasses that shade the world around us and help us interpret everything that we read. It's not the responsibility of the evidence to shine so brightly that they render those glasses ineffectual. We have to take deliberate steps to manage our bias. And my contention is we need to bracket our worldviews when we do it, and we need to look at the evidence, speak for itself, weigh it according to a proper method for best explanation, and that is how we determine what is probable. And when we do that, I do believe very sincerely, very strongly, that the resurrection hypothesis is by far the best explanation and should be regarded as what happened in the past.
Well, Mike, it's been a pleasure speaking with you, and I look forward to, you know, maybe you'll inspire more historians to tackle this question so that we can continue to refine our views and look at the evidence. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, Luke.
And that was my interview with Mike Lacona. I hope you enjoyed it. I certainly did. I won't answer any listener questions this time, but if you have a question about atheism, please visit commonsenseatheism.com and click the link Ask the Atheist, and I'll play your question on the air and answer it. That's it for today's show. This is Luke Prog, signing out.